it will definitely also affect the standing of the legal and political arguments of China over the United States. The law that was interpreted yesterday is universal law that applies to all other countries. And again, this is validated by the fact that even China, the United States, actually came, had three opportunities to try to influence the thinking of the judges. And as we have seen yesterday, to a large extent, actually, the judges were quite explicit in rebuking some of the arguments that those major polluters led forward in order to evade accountability.
Well, Sebastian, finally, you have 30 seconds. The role of national courts. The BBC said lawyers could start bringing cases as early as next week in national courts.
Absolutely. This will embolden the plaintiffs, victims of climate harms, but also hopefully judges in being more responsive to the need to apply existing law in the context of climate change. What we really need is to end an era of impunity and just actually rely on existing legal principle to hold polluters accountable, whether they are corporates or governmental. So tomorrow we expect, or like from today, starting today, we expect a new era of climate accountability.
Sebastian Dyke, I want to thank you so much for being with us, senior attorney with the Center for International Environmental Law, known as CIEL, which supported countries and their arguments before the International Court of Justice. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
I'm Naomi Klein, and you are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM.
Support for KBOO comes from our members and from Friends of Noise, presenting a two-day music festival for the documentary No Quiet Hours, a focus on the DIY music scene in Oregon. The festival is Friday, July 25th and Saturday, July 26th, from 5 to 9 p.m. both days, and will feature food, arts and crafts, and a lineup of 8 bands from across the region. Tickets and info at friendsofnoise.org. Support for KBOO comes from our members and from Metropolitan Family Services Cash Oregon, committed to improving the financial health of low to moderate income families and individuals by providing free tax preparation services. Volunteers are currently needed to support this program. All training is provided and no tax experience is necessary. More info on volunteering at cashoregon.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, controversy about the role of Oregon's First Lady still having an impact. Governor Kotek is calling for a special session on transportation as people testify about the dire need to fix roads and bridges, and protests on the way this weekend about federal funding cuts. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, July 24th, 2025. I'm Annette Newell. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. The First Lady of Oregon, Amy Kotek Wilson, faces scrutiny about her influence over Governor Tina Kotek's administration as three of Kotek's staff leave to start their own firm. KBOO's Dave Chittenden has more on this story, written by James Kemp.
Governor Tina Kotek has lost three top staff members amid rising concerns about the influence of her wife, Amy Kotek Wilson, in her administration. The three former staffers, Lindsay O'Brien, Ann Doe, and Andrea Cooper, have left their positions to launch a new political strategies firm called March Strategies. All three women bring extensive experience in state government and campaign work. Andrea Cooper previously served as chief of staff for former governor Kate Brown and worked with the Oregon House Majority Office. Lindsay O'Brien collaborated with Kotek during her tenure as Speaker of the House, while Ann Doe was the executive director of Planned Parenthood Advocates of Oregon. They expressed their commitment to tackling complex issues that significantly impact people's lives. Quote, "We are drawn to the hard problems that keep leaders awake at night." Cooper and O'Brien left Kotek's office in 2024, raising concerns about Kotek Wilson's growing influence. Their departures prompted a wave of resignations, including Ann Doe, who did not cite Kotek Wilson as a reason for her exit. In response to the scrutiny, Governor Kotek issued an apology and abandoned plans to formalize her wife's role in the administration. However, she provided little clarity on how to establish boundaries that would allow staff to voice concerns regarding Kotek Wilson's involvement. The Oregon Government Ethics Committee has opted not to investigate, stating there's no evidence that Kotek Wilson's role violates ethics laws. The newly formed March Strategies will focus on government and public affairs, coaching, and organizational development while continuing their work in campaign and advocacy sectors. In their statement, the women said, "Together, we've developed policy, shaped public conversations, and led teams that deliver results. We're excited to continue this work at March Strategies." For KBOO Evening News, I'm David Chittenden.
Meantime, Oregon Governor Tina Kotek has announced a special legislative session for late August to focus on transportation funding. She's unveiled a proposal aimed at stabilizing the Oregon Department of Transportation's budget. It would raise the state's gas tax 6 cents, increase vehicle registration fees $42, boost title fees $139, and add a $30 surcharge for electric vehicles. Kotek says these increased costs would prevent layoffs and help restore services after state lawmakers failed to pass a $12 billion transportation package this year. Oregon State Senator Con Pham, who represents the Portland area, serves on the state Senate's Transportation Committee and welcomes the governor's announcement.
Oregon's roads and bridges and our transit system have been stretched thin.
Oregonians pay less money for their roads and bridges than any other state in the American West. We're behind not just our peer states of Washington and Colorado, but also Montana, Utah, and Idaho. Last month, the legislature failed to pass a transportation package, and without new revenue, hundreds of state employees are going to be laid off. This is about the snowplow operator in Pendleton, the bridge maintenance crews on the Oregon coast, and catastrophic cuts to transit service, like the bus that I'm riding on right now. As we brace for the worsening wildfire season and the winter storms that we know are coming, we can't count on the federal government for support. Oregonians simply can't afford to lose the vital state employees that keep Oregonians safe and connected. This stopgap funding measure is not going to solve all of our problems. We still need significant investments in actually expanding transit service, not just maintaining it, as well as investments in safer streets, passenger rail service, electric vehicle chargers, and much, much more. It's unfortunate that we're going to have to wait until future legislative sessions to get these greater investments that my constituents have been demanding for years. But right now, as our federal government continues to dissolve, it's more important than ever that Oregonians can count on our state and local governments to provide basic infrastructure like roads and bridges and run transit service.
And again, that was Oregon State Senator Con Pham, who serves on the Transportation Committee. And today, a long list of people spoke to the board of the Oregon Department of Transportation about the budget woes. A lot of them are concerned about funding for the I-5 Rose Quarter Improvement Project in Portland.
My name is Doug Allen, speaking for AORTA, Association of Oregon Rail and Transit Advocates. AORTA has opposed the Rose Quarter Freeway Expansion Project for decades, going back to the 1980s. We have testified before this commission about poor design choices and failure to consider reasonable alternatives. Oregon is in crisis. Hundreds of safety-critical ODOT employees have been given layoff notices. The obvious solution is to put the Rose Quarter expansion on ice, transfer any dedicated HB 2017 money to the Abernathy Bridge, freeing up flexible money from the Abernathy project, such as dollars originally set for repainting the Fremont Bridge. That freed up money can be spent to retain valuable maintenance expertise and capability. Please act now to avoid disruption and disaster.
My name is Nate McCoy, President and CEO of the largest chapter of the National Association of Minority Contractors. I have spent 10 years at NAMAC, and let's say 7 to 8 years of that has been relying on partnerships like ODOT to hopefully bring infrastructure to our community by way of creating more economic opportunities. And so this is what our community is really tasking us to do in the heart of Portland. First and foremost, we have the urgent needs and long overdue maintenance of our roads. We have some of the worst deferred maintenance you could have. We've seen bridges collapse. We've seen roads not be in a condition for e-commerce and workers and residents to really get through transportation. And so I feel like we're at a point in time, thank God, that the governor is calling for another special session. We want to see this thing get across the finish line. I think our taxpayers deserve that. The other part, and no news to ODOT, but safety and reliability. I can't tell you enough at how unsafe a lot of our roads are. And thanks to TriMet, ODOT, PBOT for really putting forward these priorities for both our workers and for our residents. What I really want to use the last minute of my time on is the real economic development. I think we know that our state is having many, many disparities. We're fighting with our president of the nation around DEI commitments. And ODOT is in a place with leadership to really bring forward some opportunities in gentrified communities in Northeast Portland by the building of I-5. And we want to make sure that that harm is repaired by getting our folks to work. And I know you all are champions for seeing people of color, small businesses grow in our state, and this is the time to do it right now.
ODOT's current financial problems are largely of its own making. Your staff hasn't accurately predicted or managed costs and has been excessively optimistic about future revenues for mega projects. They've marched ahead with projects that they didn't have full funding for, doing anything, saying anything, just to get a project started, knowing that once it was started, you have no choice but to provide the money to finish it. This was foreseeable and foreseen. Highway builders have been pulling this stunt since Moses, Robert Moses of New York, and ODOT staff have shamelessly copied him. Take the Abernathy Bridge. It was never funded in House Bill 2017. ODOT cobbled together about $50 million from a range of sources, including maintenance funds, just to get it started, and then promised it would pay for construction out of toll revenues, which never materialized. It also underestimated the cost, which tripled from $248 million to more than $815 million.
I'm Jeff Borland. I'm the president of Raymore Construction. I am part of the team that is slated to build this. I've spent the last 7 years working and galvanizing our community. This project is one of the worst bottlenecks we know. There's also about safety and preservation. It's about bridge retrofitting. It's about drainage, all the things that is necessary for us to even go into figuring out how we get to phase one and the rest of the project. A lot of time, money, and energy has been spent by our community. We are all united to move this project forward. This is necessary in terms of economic job opportunities, and we're finally sitting at the table to where we have strong influence over the direction of a project that really hits through the center of our community.
There has been a lot said that really just sat wrong with me, right? We've had the legacy of Robert Moses invoked. We've talked about folks putting this project on ice. I mean, I just want to share a little bit about how that lands for those of us who are in this work day to day. In 1943, the city of Portland commissioned New Yorker Robert Moses, the famed urban planner and destroyer of neighborhoods, to dictate the path forward for our ever-expanding town. His task was simple: to advise civic leaders on how to best modernize Portland's transportation infrastructure. His target was our neighborhood, Lower Albina. Then home to 80% of the city's Black population, the Albina Robert Moses laid his eyes upon was a bustling residential and commercial hub nestled against the banks of the Willamette River. To Mr. Moses and the local officials that offered him up the modern day equivalent of nearly $2 million to diagnose our city's ills, Lower Albina was in the way. Build a highway through it, he said. So they did. Public leaders have always had an outsized impact on what gets built, where it gets built, and who it gets built for. In the times of Robert Moses and throughout much of the history of our state, power was prescriptive. Decision makers surveyed the land, dug in their heels, and dictated policy to the public. We are gathered here today to articulate a different vision of leadership.
Federal cuts to AmeriCorps will eliminate volunteers in rural Oregon. As Julia Tilton reports, they're serving a program that's worked in the state for three decades.
The Department of Government Efficiency ended an AmeriCorps partnership with the University of Oregon that sent volunteers to rural areas. Titus Tomlinson with the university's RARE program says their grants won't be back this fall, cutting their work with communities statewide by more than half.
The damage has been done. This type of a shock, it's resulted in us losing well over 50% of our members.
That'll impact both those communities and the young professionals AmeriCorps placed with local organizations right out of college. Professor Lauren Michelle Kramer says she's seen those optimistic, energetic volunteers help in food and agriculture for more than 10 years.
That loss will be felt, I think, for a long time, just because I'm not sure what's going to be able to take the place of programs like that.
I'm Julia Tilton.
Washingtonians will join in National Families First protests on Saturday in response to federal cuts to health care, food assistance, and other programs. Groups across the country are organizing a day of protests, including at least 9 in Washington state. In Spokane, an event will focus on cuts to health care and rural hospitals across the state. KBOO's Corbin Vail reports on this story, written by Isabel Charlet.
In response to the Trump administration's recently signed One Big Beautiful Bill Act, cuts funding for Medicaid, food assistance, and other programs. This Saturday, hundreds of peaceful protests are planned across the country, including at least 9 in Washington state. Liz Moore of the Peace and Justice Action League of Spokane is organizing an event with local healthcare unions, highlighting how federal cuts will hurt healthcare access and rural hospitals.
This bill robs hospitals and clinics of funding, including rural hospitals, and makes our already tenuous healthcare system strain and probably break at the seams. It steals healthcare coverage from 16 million adults and children.
Republican Representative Michael Baumgartner of Spokane praised the Act's $50 billion allocation for rural healthcare, though the act is expected to cut total rural healthcare spending by $155 billion. In eastern Washington, more than half of the children rely on Apple Health, the state's Medicaid system. Moore calls the act a heist.
It really bankrolls massive tax giveaways for the ultra-rich and for greedy corporations at the same time that our communities are going to be hurt, and we say no.
Many may be feeling overwhelmed in the face of mass deportations or cuts to food aid across the country, Moore adds. But people need to keep pushing against these policies.
When we see that we're not alone, when there's somebody you know at the rally you didn't know was going to be there, those feelings can keep us in motion.
Rally locations can be found online at mobilize.us/familiesfirst. For the KBOO Evening News, I'm Corbin Vail.
On July 16th, demonstrators organized a rally and protested at the Portland City Council meeting, demanding that the city councilors revoke the ICE permit to operate in the Portland Southwest McAdam facility. KBOO's Anna Wilcox has more on the story.
Portland City Councilors Angelita Morillo and Samir Canal addressed demonstrators inside Portland City Hall. Demonstrators organized a rally during the evening city council meeting on July 16th. They demanded that the Portland City Council revoke the permit for the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, office on McAdam Avenue after continued escalation of immigration detainments from the Trump administration.
Luring immigrants in with check-ins and bogus warrants, then kidnapping and trafficking them across state lines. And when community members dare to stand up against them, they respond with violence, arrests, and chemical weapons.
Earlier this month, ICE detention data shows at least 28 instances where individuals were held for over 12 hours inside the McAdam building. Conditions for the current ICE permit stipulate that no detainee can be held longer than 12 hours. Councilor Morillo told Fox 12 that if violations did occur, City Council would look into it. She said, quote, "Every councilor right now is dedicated to protecting the immigrant community." At least 2 people from the apartment complex across from the ICE facility were also present at the demonstrations.
Why are you back so today?
Because I live right across the street from the ICE facility.
How has that been going for you?
Not good. Not good at all. I've lost weight. I've also thrown up brown stomach acid. I've also had to take my child to the hospital because they shot tear gas one night. It was a couple nights ago. It's also that little, you know, thought in my head like, oh, what if I don't make it home because I'm being targeted for speaking out about this because they shot at me while I was on my balcony. I'm at home. Why are you shooting at me?
Demonstrators occupied seats in city council chamber. Portland City Council recessed in face of the demonstrations. Councilor Murillo agreed to talk with and listen to the demonstrators in a separate room.
In order for a permit to be revoked, there's a few things. First of all, there has to be an investigation done to see if we can even revoke the permit or if they've actually violated those things.
During the gathering, Councilor Murillo highlighted issues facing immigrants if McAdam's ICE office were to close.
I am also talking with immigration attorneys who have spoken extensively, who I can say are deeply rooted in working with immigrant communities and who are experts in the legal system, who have talked about the fact that their clients are now going to the, when the building closes, they go to the Tacoma Detention Center and they do not get out. It is a miracle to get someone out of Tacoma Detention. When they go there, it's a black hole. When they go to McAdam, they have a fighting chance. And I hate that those are the choices before us.
The consequences, she said, could be harmful.
There are true consequences for the immigrants on the ground if they cannot get their legal proceedings. Because I want to emphasize something very clearly. When McAdam closes the processing facility, that does not stop ICE. These people still need to have their immigration where they just get their paperwork signed. If they fail to get some of that paperwork done on time, according to ICE and to immigration, then suddenly you are in peril of losing your entire immigration status because you missed a meeting.
Councillor Murillo started to cry.
The federal government has also indicated that they are prepared to open detention centers on federal land or federal buildings, and we don't have power over them. They can do that with any federal building or any federal land that we have. And those will be actual detention centers. They will not be processing.
After over an hour of gathering, demonstrators dispersed and headed outside.
My name is Beatriz Ibarra. I am part of Portland Against Deportations and Pull the Permit Coalition. So we're both part of the groups that are trying to pull the permit. And so it went better than expected. You know, we were trying to get city council to respond to us. And so we got a few city council members to respond to us and move this forward. You know, we know that there's some ambition behind it and some like strength behind it.
For KBOA Portland, this is Anna Wilcox.
And ICE plans to add 6 immigration detention centers in Colorado. More on that story from Eric Galatis.
Centers are planned for Hudson and La Junta, and Colorado Springs and Walsenburg would each get 2 facilities, all run by private firms. Tim McDonald with ACLU Colorado says ICE should not be outsourcing centers to for-profit companies such as Geo Group, whose facility in Aurora has a history of civil rights abuses and lack of medical care.
That's a terrible model. We should not put profits on the backs of immigrants. It creates an incentive to detain more innocent men, women, and children.
McDonald points to a 2019 report documenting abuse, neglect, and even death at GEO's Aurora Detention Center. In 2024, the family of Melvin Mendoza filed a wrongful death lawsuit against the facility for failing to diagnose and treat a blood clot in Mendoza's leg. GEO did not respond to questions about the Mendoza suit, but said by email that they are proud of their 40 years of work with ICE and strictly comply with ICE detention standards. President Donald Trump campaigned on the promise of mass deportations, and as of last week, more than 56,000 people have been detained. That's according to track analysis of ICE data, which also found that more than 70% of people being detained have no criminal record. McDonald notes Trump also promised to prioritize deporting violent criminals.
We know that's not happening. They're detaining and removing grandmothers, pregnant women.
This is Eric Galatis.
The Trump administration hammers away at Obama as frenzy over the Epstein files continues. FEMA's Director of Defense Actions in Texas floods, and Miami voters will head to the polls in November after a lawsuit. For more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2025 Talks.
Everything that House Republicans have done, everything this administration has done since Donald Trump took office, is in defense of the elites.
Massachusetts Representative Catherine Clark is slamming House Republicans for going on recess to avoid releasing files on convicted child sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein. The minority whip and all Democrats, along with about a dozen in the GOP, support forcing records on the multimillionaire pedophile and longtime friend of the president be made public. President Donald Trump and Attorney General Pam Bondi say there is nothing important in them, but the Wall Street Journal reports this spring, Bondi told Trump his name appears multiple times in what she reportedly called a truckload of documents. Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard Wednesday says she's sending prosecutors evidence of treason by former President Barack Obama and his staff, who Gabbard claims ordered the creation of an intelligence assessment that falsely claimed Russia colluded to help elect Trump in 2016.
They knew it would promote this contrived narrative that Russia interfered in the 2016 election to help President Trump win.
Allies of the former president say Gabbard is intentionally distorting the assessment and related intelligence, and ignoring evidence Russia did aid Trump in order to distract attention from the Epstein files. Acting FEMA Director David Richardson is defending the agency's response to flooding in Central Texas from bipartisan criticism. The New York Times reported that call center contractors were laid off at the end of their contracts on July 5th. The next day, only a third of calls were answered. Richardson argued at a congressional hearing that the reporting was untrue.
The majority of the calls were answered.
The Times cited a new policy at the Department of Homeland Security, which requires Secretary Kristi Noem's signature for any expense greater than $100,000. Search and rescue teams were not approved until 3 days after the flood, which one search and rescue leader cited when announcing his resignation. The conservative majority on the Supreme Court will allow Trump to fire three Democrats on the traditionally bipartisan Consumer Product Safety Commission. Following a lawsuit, Miami voters will head to the polls as scheduled, despite efforts from the city officials to unilaterally extend their time in office. Three of five city council members and the mayor of Miami signed off on postponing elections by a year. Eileen Higgins is running against the incumbent mayor.
I had always thought the vote that the commissioners took to give themselves more time in office without asking the voters' permission was going to be found illegal, and it has been.
Supporters of changing the election date wanted to increase voter turnout and cut costs by running local elections during campaigns for president and governor. I'm Zimon Perez.
Alaska Native villages seek to harness the power of the ocean for energy, and Kirkland is a step closer to becoming head of Indian Affairs. Here's today's edition of National Native News.
Two villages in Alaska are considering a project that would harness the energy of ocean waves, potentially for the first time in the U.S. Ayolna Naiden with the Alaska Desk has more.
Waves gently hit the shores of Kachemak Bay as ravens croak above on a cloudy night in July. The small village of Port Graham is nested here at the southern tip of the Kenai Peninsula. The village may soon convert wave energy into electricity. Danielle Malchev is the first chief of Port Graham.
I have a lot of hope that this is going to be something great for our community.
Chugachmut is a consortium that serves native tribes, including Port Graham and its neighbor, Nanwalik. The consortium announced it had partnered with an Australia-based company, Carnegie Clean Energy, in May. Carnegie has several wave energy projects across the world, but this would be the company's first commercial installment in the U.S. That's according to Louise Richardson, Carnegie's commercial analyst.
One thing at Carnegie that we hope our technology will be able to service in the future is remote communities and isolated communities that might not have access to other forms of renewable energy options.
Port Graham and Nanwalik have no roads connecting them to the rest of the state. Energy costs there are high because the villages are at the edge of the grid and diesel for a backup generator comes on a barge. The electrical lines running from Homer are several decades old, don't have enough capacity, and are unreliable. Malchev says the village loses power several times a month in winter and once every few months in summer.
We have to use satellite phones if our power is out, which isn't very convenient when you're trying to relay and talk to doctors in the ER and you're dealing with a patient.
Malchev says more reliable electricity from wave energy could solve some of those issues. In Anchorage, I am Alona Naiden.
In February, President Trump tapped a Navajo man to become the next Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, the nominee is one step closer to being sworn in as a top-ranking official, second only to Interior Secretary Doug Burgum.
William Billy Kirkland III was Special Assistant to the President and Deputy Director of Intergovernmental Affairs during Trump's first term. In his recent Senate confirmation hearing, Kirkland took credit for helping Trump establish Operation Lady Justice, a federal task force on missing and murdered indigenous peoples, and for inviting the Navajo Code Talkers to the Oval Office.
President Trump and Secretary Burgum love and appreciate and respect Indian country.
New Mexico Senator Ben Ray Lujan disagreed.
Do you think the administration cutting billions from national programs that support Indian country, Native American communities' lives lives up to America's trust responsibility?
Sir, I look forward, once confirmed, to working with you, your staff, this committee, and most importantly, tribal leaders to prioritize the money that Congress appropriates for the Office of Indian Affairs to make sure it's best and most wisely invested.
If confirmed, Kirkland would be responsible for upholding tribal trust and treaty obligations on behalf of the federal government. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Shonico, an Oregon town just southeast of Mount Hood, has opened an Old West-style saloon. KBOO's Dave Chittenden has more.
Oregon's most famous ghost town now has an Old West-styled watering hole open on the weekends. And just like the 1910s, there's a saloon, a hotel, and the chance of a gunfight. At its height in 1910, Shonico had about 600 residents and a reputation as a rowdy place. A 1908 article in the Oregonian described the small town as, quote, an oasis in a saloonless region. Shonico takes pride in its status as a ghost town. Although it is a functioning municipality with about 24 full-time residents, the decor of the saloon, vintage newspaper, and tree stumps as stools transports visitors back in time to around 1901. The town mainly failed due to the opening of a rival railroad and a fire that destroyed much of the town in 1911. The saloon building was originally a garage for a wool warehouse before being moved from its original location and then converted into an old-time saloon in the 1980s. In the past, the Shonico Historic Preservation Guild contracted with the High Desert Rangers Gunfighters Club and would open the saloon during the annual celebration, Shonico Days. This summer, the president of the Gunfighters Club is aiming to opening every weekend, offering a selection of root beers, sodas, and adult beverages with wings and nachos ready to serve. There's a fire pit out back, where on the last Saturday of the month, locals and visitors gather for bluegrass jam sessions. Benjamin Harleman, the president of the Gunfighters Club, said, quote, "Everybody who comes in loves it. We have people here who fall in love with it so much they'll hang out until they can't stay awake any longer sitting by the fire," end quote. The Gunfighters Club stage mock gunfights during Shonico Days, held the first weekend in August, but if there's a crowd, they will put on a show, even keeping fake warrants behind the bar to take people to the original Shonico Jail. For KBOO Evening News, I'm David Chittenden.
So glad to have you with us as you're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, July 24th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Dave Chittenden, James Kemp, Anna Wilcox, Corbin Vale, and Isabel Charlet. The producer is Annette Newman.